This is AMDA On The Go, your gateway to expert discussions, journal article reviews, and innovation in post-acute and long-term care. AMDA On The Go is a presentation of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this podcast is brought to you by Avalum Health, the makers of the TheraWorks Protect U-Pack. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now here's our host for AMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to AMDA On The Go. This podcast will focus on pressure injuries in the post-acute and long-term care setting. The numbers are remarkable. According to Section 2 of a 2016 Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, sponsored study entitled Skilled Nursing Facility Quality Reporting Program, Specifications for Percent of Residents or Patients with Pressure Ulcers That Are New or Worsened. Pressure ulcer incidence rates were up to 24%, with nearly 10,000 stage 3 or 4 diagnosis claims in 2009. In 2006, the cost of treating a stage 4 pressure ulcer could be as high as $19,000. And by 2010, 90-day episodes of care payments by CMS increased by $18.8 million per year after a hospital stay. According to the Hospital Quality Institute, with more than 2.5 million patients affected by pressure injuries in 2008, total costs in the United States approached $11 billion. It appears that despite reviews and education in wound assessment, staging and management, the presence of wound care specialists, continuous in-servicing, and an abundance of products for treatments, the healthcare system continues to be overwhelmed with pressure injuries throughout the continuum. Why? Is it because the population is aging, more ill, nutritionally compromised, frail, or is it something more? We've all experienced the worst of decubiti, caused by a variety of reasons. And despite the best of efforts and intentions, there is ongoing scrutiny, penalties, and legalities around pressure injuries. What are we missing? Well, I can think of no one better to foster this discussion than geriatrician, author, and educator in pressure injury assessment and management, Dr. Jeffrey Levine. And we are very fortunate to have Dr. Levine with us now. Dr. Levine is a practicing physician in New York City. He is an associate professor of geriatrics and palliative care at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. He is board certified in internal medicine and geriatric medicine, is a certified medical director and certified wound care specialist physician. He has been actively involved in AMDA's educational efforts in promoting wound care skills among primary care practitioners. Dr. Levine is an alumnus of the National Pressure Advisory Panel and speaks widely on the topic of wound care in older patients. His publications include Wound Care Chapter in the Geriatric Review Syllabus, published by the American Geriatric Society, and he's co-authored a book, Pocket Guide to Pressure Ulcers, published by the New Jersey Hospital Association, that is currently the wound guide of choice in many post-acute and long-term care facilities across America. And Dr. Levine, welcome to AMDA On The Go.
Well, Wayne, thank you very much for inviting me, and I'm very honored to have this opportunity to address the AMDA audience.
Dr. Levine, I typically like to start the conversation with somewhat of a historical perspective to set our framework for discussion. Considerations around decubiti have not been without some attention over the past few years. In 2016, the PUAP introduced the term injury rather than ulcer. It also updated the staging terminology. NPUAP changes were soon thereafter adopted by the Joint Commission. But in 2017, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine, AMDA, the House of Delegates cited concerns around unintended litigation and regulatory consequences and voted to oppose a resolution adopting the term injury. And it urged the American Medical Association to do the same. Interestingly, the lead review article from the October 2019 Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology is entitled Pressure Ulcers: Pathophysiology, Epidemiology, Risk Factors, and Presentation. What is the concern with terminology? Is there a difference between decubitus ulcer, pressure injury, or pressure ulcer when it comes to assessment or treatment, especially for our providers in the trenches and where they're concerned? Give us a status update, if you would, considering the evolution of the discussion and where we should be thinking today.
Well, thanks for the question, Wayne. That is really a great question, and I'd like to take a moment to actually put the history in actually maybe a little bit better perspective, because decubitus ulcers have been described for centuries, and Jean-Martin Charcot in the 19th century provided the first classification scheme. He divided bed sores into the decubitus acutus, or the acute bed sore, the decubitus chronicus, or the chronic bed sore, and the decubitus aminosus, which is the wound that heralds death. Since that time, there's been a number of classification schemes, but the current one is based on the four-stage system described by an orthopedic surgeon named Shea that was originally published in 1975. Since then, and over the years, bed sores have gotten a number of names, including decubiti, decubitus ulcers, pressure sores, pressure ulcers, and pressure injuries. In 2016, the NPUAP, of which I'm an alumnus, decided to change the official name of this lesion to pressure injury for a number of reasons. But the main one was that stage one is not a skin break at all. Therefore, stage one is not an ulcer. This unfortunately caused a tempest in the wound care world with the main consideration that it was a gift to plaintiff attorneys. But despite this tempest, the new terminology has had good penetration into the wound care and regulatory community, and has indeed been adopted by CMS in their verbiage. Mm. The industry of lawsuits about pressure ulcers was already in full swing when this change was made, and I truly doubt whether this change really had the impact that was predicted by some members of the medical community. The recent review in the dermatology journal that you cited joined the fray by declaring that ulcer, and if you read the text, it said that ulcer is still more widely accepted than injury, which frankly is an uninformed statement. And within the article, they actually say that the NPUAP guidelines should be followed. Wow. So unfortunately, this is unfortunate for the dermatology journal, for that particular dermatology journal, and for their editorial process, because it is clearly internally inconsistent. NPUAP is known as and has been the last word for policy in pressure ulcers and pressure injuries. And, you know, we may not agree with it, but that's the way it is, and it's already been adopted by CMS. Wow. But I have to tell you something. We at the front lines shouldn't be wasting time arguing about this terminology. As far as I am concerned, we at the front lines, for us at the front lines, all these terms are synonymous, with the preferred term being pressure injury as designated by NPUAP. As long as you use one of these terms, decubitus, decubitus ulcer, pressure injury, it's fine with me, as long as you don't try to misclassify it as something it's not. Like, for example, a skin tear or a shear injury or any other creative term to avoid getting a quality-related citation. Mm-hmm. Pressure ulcers already have a well-embedded public perception of representing quality deficit, but that's not always the case. Plaintiff lawyers will always find ways to attribute negligence to our doctors and facilities, and we need to look toward providing proactive quality care by developing working systems for wound care as mandated by the CMS interpretive guidelines in FTAG 686. That number, FTAG 686, was formerly FTAG 314 for those of us who remember these things. And this comes directly from the federal regulations set forth in CFR section 483.2 that was originally passed as the Nursing Home Reform Amendments in 1987. Now, what this means is that we need wound care knowledge among our medical directors, doctors, and other primary care providers, along with qualified wound care practitioners who are skilled in both communicating with nurses, doctors, nutritionists, and families, as well as judicious decision-making for wound care. This knowledge base includes such things as prevention modalities, wound assessment, recognition and treatment of infection, recognition and identification of other conditions, such as moisture-associated skin damage and fungal infections, the importance of nutrition with collaboration with speech therapists and nutritionists, knowledge of palliative care principles, knowledge of our product armamentarium, and proper product choice, and when to refer to a surgeon and when to sharply debride.
Wow.
So, you know, extending this thought, in 2016, you authored a Caring for the Ages article entitled Wound Care, What the Medical Director Needs to Know. In your comprehensive review, you discuss the many facets you've just mentioned of care, the different team members or outside vendors potentially involved in the use of a variety of different wound care products, which themselves have seemed to explode with a varying mechanisms of action and definitely varying prices. In May of 2019, CMS updated its outcome measures for hospital harm that included monitoring for stage 2 pressure injuries. I can only imagine that this level of scrutiny is going to eventually extend to post-acute care. What would be the ideal wound assessment setup for a skilled nursing facility? What would the team look like? What would be the basic products to have on hand? Have any models been successful in reducing incidence or prevalence of pressure injuries in the skilled setting?
Wow. So, Wayne, that's a lot of questions, and I'm going to try to get to them within the time frame. Each subcomponent of your question, I could actually spend at least 45 minutes to an hour on, but I'll do my best. So, CMS has long recognized that pressure injuries might be reflective of quality, and long-term care facilities have long been ahead of the curve in acknowledging this. They were way ahead of the curve way ahead of hospitals on this curve, because long-term care facilities started to get on board in 1987 when the nursing home reform amendments were passed, where it specifically linked quality to pressure injuries. Hospitals have only come into the picture long after this was a recognized issue for nursing homes, which began with the nursing home reform amendments of 1987. And this really got a boost in 2008 as part of the pay for performance initiative that was promulgated by CMS when they brought hospitals into the picture by designating stage 3 and 4 wounds as levels qualifying for denial of the upcoding for medical complexity, thus penalizing hospitals with stopping their advanced payment for these lesions when they occurred after admission.
Right.
And as you stated, CMS has recently developed a new measure. They call it the Electronic Clinical Quality Measure, or ECQM. And among these ECQMs, they designated, and I'm using their verbiage, hospital harm pressure injuries. Imagine that. They actually call this hospital harm, and they include stages 2, 3, and 4, as well as unstageables and DTIs. Mm-hmm. So this is a wide expansion of the target for quality, for penalizing, potentially penalizing hospitals for these injuries.
Wow.
So while it is true that pressure injuries can be sometimes reflective of quality nursing care and generally quality care, i.e. things like continence care, turning, proper bed surfaces, provision of nutrition, et cetera, this designation of pressure injuries as a quality measure in this latest ECQM, Electronic Clinical Quality Measure, actually ignores the push toward adopting the concept of skin failure, which I've been promulgating and I've been talking about for the last couple of years. I wrote an article in JAMDA about this. And this is a definition for unavoidable wounds that I've proposed and published in not only in JAMDA, but in other places. And this is when pressure injuries develop even when all aspects of prevention as recommended by clinical practice guidelines are implemented. Every one of us who's taking care of patients on the front lines, hospitals, nursing homes, outpatient, have seen this happen. And my definition for skin failure is that it's a state in which tissue tolerance is so compromised that cells can no longer survive in zones of physiologic impairment, such as hypoxia, local mechanical stresses, impaired delivery of nutrients, and buildup of toxic metabolic byproducts.
Wow.
We at the front lines have long recognized that there are patients with intrinsic characteristics that engender pressure injuries that are unavoidable, even though we've administered care that incorporates all components of clinical practice guidelines for pressure injury prevention. In such cases, we and our facilities shouldn't be penalized if ulcers form in these individuals. Unfortunately, research has not yet given us a bulletproof algorithm that predicts avoidability or unavoidability, and there is currently no biomarker for the unavoidability of some wounds. You know, that said, even with the acceptance of unavoidability of some wounds, we should not let our guard down with regard to provision of prevention techniques and proactive quality care. As far as the recognition of quality deficits resulting in wounds, long-term care was far ahead of hospitals in recognizing this as it was built into the federal regs that I mentioned, which is the Nursing Home Reform Amendments, also called OBRA 1987. Right. Skin assessment has long been part and parcel of the resident assessment instrument, or the RAI, with the minimum data set, or the MDS, and the care planning process. The ideal wound care system starts at the top with knowledgeable and involved administrators and medical directors, involved primary care docs who take the time to examine all wounds and document what they see, competent wound care personnel and consultants, and involvement of all disciplines in skin assessment, pressure relief intervention, nutrition, and informed choices regarding treatment, including incorporation of palliative care principles for wounds that are not expected to heal. We in the PALTC community know about all these parameters. It's nothing new, and it's not rocket science. Mm. The key is getting the administrative commitment to back us up and provide appropriate resources to make this happen, along with medical directors and primary care practitioners who are familiar with basic concepts. As far as choice of products that you asked about, Wayne, that is at least an hour discussion, which we don't have time for today, okay? But I should tell you in general that choices of products is made extra challenging because most of our wound care modalities, including foams, hydrogels, alginates, hydrocolloids, and others, right, have been identified by the FDA as devices and not pharmaceuticals, and are therefore not subject to rigorous controlled trials that show either efficacy and certainly don't show comparative effectiveness with other modalities. Wow. And that hampers us in our choices. Now, nonetheless, there are basic principles that we can use. The most common principle that we're using now is wound bed preparation, which includes basic principles of keeping the wound moist but not too moist, making sure that the surface is free of necrosis and debris, and making sure that drainage is absorbed. Recognize infection and diagnose infection. The whole patient is taken care of from a geriatric standpoint, including nutrition.
We will return to our interview after this brief message from Avadam, the creators of TheraWorks. What are you missing to drive better outcomes for recurrent UTI patients, from mounting antibiotic-resistant concerns to unproven over-the-counter remedies? Your options for preventing urinary tract infections in post-acute care facilities have been limited until now, safe for a variety of urogenital uses and won't contribute to resistance. The TheraWorks Protect UPAC is the safe, clinically proven, convenient hygiene solution you've been missing. To learn more about how the UPAC can become part of your UTI prevention protocols, visit seewhatsmissing.com.
We are having an amazing conversation with geriatrician and leading authority on pressure injuries, Dr. Jeffrey Levine. Dr. Levine, you talked about palliative care, and I want to extend that just a little bit. In a 2014 article in Advances in Wound Care entitled "What Do Patients Want? Patient Preference in Wound Care," authors Corbett and Ennis discussed the barriers and opportunities in providing patient-centered care and effectively managing wounds. Yet, they conclude that eliciting and translating patient preference into wound care is challenging. Today, what is the role for shared decision-making in wound care? Should we make wound care a part of an advanced care planning discussion, given the risk that our complex patients have in developing wounds that will more likely than not impair quality of life, lead to hospitalizations, and significant medical expenditures?
That is a great question, Wayne. One of the reasons shared decision-making for wound care is such a challenge is that there's currently no centralized specialty for wound care. Today is therefore like a Tower of Babel, with different specialties, each with their own vocabulary tools involved in decision-making. For example, there are podiatrists, general surgeons, plastic surgeons, vascular surgeons, ostomy nurses, and geriatricians, all in the mix, often without a shared basis for decision-making and sometimes completely different vocabularies. Even emergency room doctors have gotten into the wound care arena with their involvement in hyperbaric medicine, and they have their own vocabulary and training. Unfortunately, many of these specialties I mentioned have little in common with geriatrics, long-term care, and palliative care. I'll give you some more examples. A vascular surgeon may not have training or expertise in geriatrics or palliative care. A geriatrician may have little knowledge about current techniques and technologies for grafting using engineered skin substitutes, which are now on the rise in wound care technologies. This is one of the biggest challenges when presenting information to families, as they often hear widely different plans from different providers. The unfortunate reality is that geriatrics, although they have embraced pressure ulcers as a geriatric syndrome, the field has offered little scholarship in wound care, and wound care remains undertaught and underrepresented both in geriatrics and in medical training, both undergraduate and graduate levels.
Wow.
And I'll give you an example. In the recent American Geriatric Society meeting in Portland, Oregon, there were over 1,000 abstracts presented, but only one, can you believe it, only one abstract referenced wound care, and that was mine, that I did with a Mount Sinai Geriatrics Fellow.
Wow.
So there's another major consideration that we haven't yet discussed. With the transformation of the nursing home into a subacute facility, and with advances in surgery and life support measures, including limb salvage procedures, more and more of our wounds in PALTC are other than pressure injuries. These include surgical wounds, arterial wounds, venous ulcers, trauma wounds, burns, and wounds related to malignancy, and others. All the more reason that medical directors and providers in LTC need education and training in managing complex, chronically ill patients with not just pressure injuries, but all types of wounds. The challenge is huge, and I applaud AMDA PALTC for being on the front lines and presenting education and resources on this topic. But I would like to state that there is still a long ways to go. All of this said, and in answer to your question, families and the public need to recognize that sometimes wounds are an unavoidable component of changes associated with acute illness, chronic illness, and the end-of-life period. In addition, it's sometimes unrealistic to expect wounds to heal, particularly in irreversible malnutrition or in the face of changes at the end of life, along with the attendant comorbidities. This knowledge needs to be incorporated into counseling and particularly end-of-life decision-making. This becomes even more important when aggressive care is chosen in the face of futile illness by families and loved ones and patients themselves. Wound care counseling is a must. You can't have aggressive life prolongation at the end of life without accepting potential consequences of further outcomes, such as pressure injuries, non-healing wounds, and other things, for example, aspiration pneumonia and urinary tract infections. It's just not realistic.
Dr. Levine, as has become customary in the time that we're remaining, I wish to be a little provocative with you, and I think this question will kind of put a cap very nicely on this discussion, given everything you've said thus far. I recall, personally, a frail elder with end-stage dementia that I came to see during a home visit very early in my training. She had one daughter who was involved in her care, and she did not have any access to any extra equipment, no hospital bed, nothing else like that. Her daughter helped to keep her skin absolutely pristine. She was on her own, it was at the end of her mother's life when skin failure should have been an issue, as you've discussed. You know, we have patients and residents in the skilled nursing setting who should have enough personnel and equipment to prevent pressure injuries. But we know this isn't the case. And you've talked about some of the complications. And we have quality metrics to show that it's not the case. You've written that because advanced age is associated with many pressure ulcers, geriatricians have a responsibility to shape the future of care for these wounds. What are we missing or lacking when it comes to preventing and managing pressure injuries?
Well, thank you, Wayne, for that question. But this is not so much a provocative question, as you stated, but rather an essential question that goes to the heart of determining avoidability and unavoidability that we all need to think about. Every one of our patients, each patient, presents a unique and complex array of medical history, illnesses, lab results, genetics, and psychosocial profile that needs to be approached on an individual basis. I can't comment upon the patient that you cited not knowing these details. However, in general, geriatricians and long-term care practitioners cannot delegate all of these complex wound care decisions to other specialties. Wounds manifest themselves in skin, which is an organ, and the largest organ of the body. Skin can fail just like any other organ. One of the unique differences between skin and other organs is that we don't have a biomarker for skin failure. We've got a BUN and creatinine for kidneys, PO2 for ventilator failure, ejection fraction for congestive heart failure, LFTs, INR, and ammonia levels for liver failure, but nothing similar to skin. Imagine that skin is still the largest and one of the most complex, if not the most complex, organ in the body. Skin care has traditionally been delegated to nurses, but I firmly believe that wounds are a medical problem and not just a nursing issue. As a medical problem, it is my belief that surgeons indeed have a role, but the primary caregiver must accept this as their responsibility. And we need to learn from our highly trained nurses who often have storehouses of knowledge on wound care. This will take education and training, as well as man and woman power. And AMDA, PALTC, has been at the forefront of this effort. But again, the job is far from complete.
Wow, what a conversation. We have been privileged to speak with and learn from Dr. Jeffrey Levine. Dr. Levine, thank you so much for spending your time with AMDA On The Go.
It's been my pleasure, Wayne. Thank you.
References for this podcast can be found at paltc.org/podcast. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for this innovation podcast that we call AMDA On The Go.
Support for this broadcast is provided by Avadem Health, the creators of TheraWorks Protect. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM, pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, please email cmd@paltc.org with your name and the podcast title. Thank you.